Been killing babies in Sudan and Afghanistan. It's a part of the master plan.
Yo, in 1961, Fred Eisenhower cautioned.
Welcome to the Voices from the Frontline segment of the 4 o'clock Public Affairs Hour on KPFK 90.7 FM in Los Angeles, 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara. This is Tammy Bang-Lu, and I'm here with my co-host, Eric Mann. We have a treat for you today, so we'll open up the hour with one of the foremost scholars on world systems theory and political economy. Emmanuel Wallerstein will be joining us to talk about the state of U.S. imperialism and the upcoming U.S. presidential elections. Then we'll go over to Jeff Cohen to talk about his role in organizing the Nader 2000 leaders united to defeat Bush and his thoughts on the role of the progressive movement in the elections. We'll be right back.
Because it's law descent, it's law defense. The poor are sent to fight the war for the bitches. Ain't nobody stopping them now, it's big business. Who's living in pots privatized up in the pen? Belly beats it while they graze pork chops again. Cut down the tree, now we can't see me or pretend.
How you doing? This is Eric Mann on Voices from the Frontline, the 4 o'clock Public Affairs Hour. I'm on the interview with Emmanuel Wallerstein. Emmanuel, are you with us?
Yeah.
You're not against us, right? You are with us.
I'm with you.
Okay, good. That's a good beginning. So, very nice. I mean, I think that the format you've developed from the Fernand Braudel Center, these three-page or two-page commentaries that you generate, I read almost all of them, and most of the people at the Labor Community Strategy Center read them too. I'm going to try to put together three of them today. Number 142 is a primer on the U.S. presidential election. Number 144, which is neither feared nor loved about the United States, commentary number 144. And commentary number 145 on what has the U.S. achieved in Iraq. One thing I wanted to ask you is that since we know that the United States as an imperialist power is always in a state of contradiction, that Lenin said that imperialism was the declining state of capitalism in its moribund stage. Mao, as you pointed out in one of these, said that the United States is a paper tiger. And you question whether or not Mao was right then, but say the basic argument is right now. I have sort of two related questions. One is that what is unique about the specific period in history that you think that the United States is in a unique period of decline right now, despite what looks like in many ways power? And two, how would you relate that to the Iraq situation? Where do you see the signs of decline in Iraq?
Well, I don't know if it's unique. The United States was the hegemonic power, unquestionably on top of the world, basically from about 1945 to 1970. And it's been in a period of relative decline ever since. That's happened before in history. That happened with Great Britain. It happened with the United Provinces. The powers that are on top tend to lose that. By overstretch, because it costs too much, because they strain their internal communities' tolerance of it, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It's quite normal. The question is what you do about it, and what great powers, those who have been hegemonic, want to do is stay on top as long as they can, and of course the U.S. has been trying to do that, and from Nixon to Clinton, or even to the first year of George W. Bush, all the presidents of the United States followed a standard policy, which I call soft multilateralism, and which was designed not to stop the decline, but to slow it down as much as possible. And I think they used three major mechanisms to do that. One was offering so-called partnership to the West Europeans and Japan as a sort of don't leave us, boys, don't get out totally from under us, because we'll play with you and we'll give you some say. And the second thing is they had a big campaign about stopping proliferation of nuclear weapons, because that really endangers U.S. military supremacy. And thirdly, they ditched the old developmentalist theme of countries developing by import substitution, and said, you know, everybody, there's no alternative. You've got to be part of this globalization thing, so we can invest freely and move our capital in and out of your countries. And if you look at those 30 years from 1970 to 2000, you have to say this was not a perfectly successful policy, but it was a reasonably successful policy. It's a glass half full. They did slow down the decline. The Europeans didn't pull away completely. Countries didn't proliferate. They stopped a couple of countries who were starting on that path, and they certainly got a long way with the theme of globalization and getting countries to change their state policies on movements of capital and so forth. So in all these ways, it was a 50-50, but better than not doing it at all.
And you think in the first year of the Bush administration there's been a break?
Yes, I do, because I think what distinguishes the neocons, and it didn't start with 2001, you can read their writings going back 10 or 20 years, is they thought this was crazy. They thought that the reason we're declining, the U.S. is declining, is not because there's some structural factors in the world system, and all you can do is slow it down. They said it's just a bunch of lousy leaders who don't have the guts to pursue a really tough policy. And if you pursued a really tough policy, we'd be way up on top. Incidentally, Reagan is one of those leaders. And I've been saying that for a long time, but along came Dick Cheney just 2 weeks ago to include Ronald Reagan specifically in the missteps when he pulled out of Lebanon in 1982. So they said, look, it's crazy. What you have to do is you have to be macho military. You have to really show your toughness, and you have to do it unilaterally. That's not second best. That's first best, because that shows you don't need anybody. You just can do it. And then everything will be hotsy-totsy, they said, because at that point the West Europeans will be intimidated. They won't. They'll give up all these ideas of being independent. Nobody will dare proliferate the nuclear weapons, and nobody will resist globalization in any way.
And the question is, since they've had the Vulcan groups and all these who have argued, that in declining capitalism, this is the time for hardline. Are they wrong?
Yeah, they're wrong because the proof is in the pudding. I mean, they picked Iraq as their goal from the beginning, and they already said that in 1997. They didn't have to wait to 9/11 to do that. But Iraq is the number one goal. Why? Iraq humiliated the United States by Saddam Hussein surviving the first Gulf War. We didn't really win that war. And then the second is Iraq's an easy target. We went into Iraq not because they had weapons of mass destruction, but because they didn't have weapons of mass destruction. And we knew it. And we thought, well, this is a pushover. And thirdly, of course, they're in a crucial geographical position, oil, and so forth and so on. So that we get that in the process. And they went in, when George Bush went on that aircraft carrier and said mission accomplished, he really thought the mission was accomplished. That wasn't a line. He really thought it was accomplished because, after all, our troops had rolled into Baghdad, and somehow the Iraqi army seemed to disintegrate or disappear or what you will. What he didn't know is that they went into the hills. And of course, at that point, everything went wrong. The military campaign is really in a quagmire, as any military man who's not in active service and therefore can speak has been saying very, very, very loudly. General Zinni put it very well. He said, stay the course. We're going over a cliff. You don't want to stay the course. We've stretched our armed forces to the limit. We don't have a man to spare or a woman to spare. And are the Europeans intimidated? Quite the contrary. They've never been more distant from the United States. They really have broken with the United States in very fundamental ways. Have the country stopped proliferating? On the contrary, North Korea and Iran have speeded it up, and a whole lot of other countries are talking about it. Brazil is talking about it, and so forth. So, proliferation is expanding, and as for being loved and cheered in the Muslim or Arab world, you got to be kidding. So they've really messed it up totally. They've so messed it up that we can't go back to the Nixon to Clinton policy. That's what Kerry seems to think he can do, but he's going to find out that he can't, because George Bush has ruined it for him. If he becomes president, it just won't work anymore. It worked up to a point for 30 years, but now we're really in a mess. So it's a kind of catastrophic free fall of U.S. power in the world, brought about precisely by the people who thought that they were going to make the U.S., put the U.S. back on top of the world.
Well, I've done a book that I'd like to send you, actually. It's called The 2004 Elections, A Turning Point for the U.S. Left.
Okay.
And
who wrote it?
Eric Mann. One of my favorite authors.
Okay, very
so,
good. I'd love to read it.
Okay, great. And one of the things that I talk about is that one of the things that the Bush administration is doing, which is very frightening, is eliminating the model of national liberation movements, or eliminating the model of autarky, eliminating the model of self-sufficient self-determination, creating almost a situation where small armed groups is the only form almost that's being tolerated. That is, if you overthrow Allende, and then if you try to overthrow in Venezuela, Hugo Chavez, fortunately, that's an incredible victory. Is the United States precluding, by getting rid of Mossadegh, which is much earlier than the present, making the situation that people's war is vulnerable to shock and awe, but occupation is a terrible tactic? In other words, basically, are we going to be in a cycle of U.S. occupations followed by what we want to call terrorists? And notice how even John Kerry is now using the word insurgents as a bad word. So you've gone from being a communist to a socialist to a terrorist, and now anyone who just opposes the U.S. occupation is called an insurgent. Is there, given what your point is, the danger of the United States becoming like Israel, a settler state, in this case a settler state that settles the whole world, and that the so-called life that we have here is a cycle of increased armed attacks, either inside or outside the United States, followed by a cycle of Patriot Acts, followed by a growing weariness of the political process and a potential for fascism at home to support this at a time when the economic conditions for people are terrible? Now, there's some upsides I'll get to later, but is at least one scenario that this cycle of barbarism, which I consider the United States the advocate of, creates that the only form possible for resistance is let them take over your country and then start essentially a guerrilla movement, which is what you're saying, that the so-called terrorists are fundamentally guerrillas.
Well, look, I think, you know, it's very possible. But there are other factors to put into the equation. It seems to me, look, over the next 4 years, the U.S. has a choice, a simple choice in Iraq. It can pull out very fast, or it can pull out later. It's going to pull out sooner or later because it's going to be pushed out the way it was pushed out in Vietnam. When it pulls out, whether it pulls out in January 2005 or January 2009, when it pulls out, there's going to be a tremendous, vicious debate in the United States about who lost Iraq. And the country
That's right.
is going to be split right down the middle, ferociously. A blame game. That's going to be very nasty, much nastier than what happened after Vietnam. And yes, I worry very much about internal struggle within the United States of a very unpleasant kind. It's not going to be a bed of roses, I don't think. And do some people want to install a tough fascist-like regime, probably quite a few people want to do that, and others are going to resist it. So it's not going to be easy. It's not a pushover for anybody what's going to happen internally in the U.S. But I don't think the U.S. is going to be able to play this game worldwide, because the cost of that, both the financial cost and the cost in U.S. lives, not to speak of prestige, political power, and all these other things, but just in those two things that hit home to Americans, is going to be so enormous. It already is so enormous, but it'll just escalate from 1,000 to 10,000 lives lost, from a $3 trillion deficit to a $6 trillion deficit. You can't do it. The U.S. can't do it. That's one of the problems for the U.S. right now, and that's why it's going to pull back. And then you're going to have a big swing, and these people who are super interventionists may become super isolationists, but they're going to be nasty.
Well, let me give you a couple of...
internal fight here.
Well, we both agree on that, and that's very helpful. Let me raise a couple of optimistic points domestically and internationally and see what you think of that. On the domestic front, which is where we do most of our organizing for that, the Labor Community Strategy Center, from an internationalist point of view,
right.
The one thing that's really almost beyond belief to a middle-class audience that doesn't experience it has been the ferocious deterioration of the standard of living of black and Latino people in this country.
Mm-hmm.
The destruction of the social welfare state, mm-hmm. the closing of trauma centers, the middle class, the so-called middle class, which nobody wants to call the working class, you know, the white working class life deteriorating like crazy. You can't afford Alzheimer's. You can't afford most people leaving paycheck to paycheck. Kerry's not even running on a social welfare discussion. That's going to have its moment to replay itself.
And when the dollar collapses, I mean, it's in a slow decline, but when it really collapses, then that standard of living in the United States is really going to go down much more sharply still. So, yeah, it's going to hit home to your white working class, middle class, in quotes, group, the people who may today not feel fully involved or not understanding the situation totally, but it'll begin to hit them sharply.
Okay, so you have the question.
Will be serious.
So you have the implication of the falling dollar, which we'll come back to. Tell us a little bit about where you see the countervailing powers internationally. Tell us a little bit about China and India in particular, and maybe Venezuela as three models.
Well,
do you see those countries as making certain incursions on the political or economic power of the United States?
Well, sure, but those are three very different examples.
Right.
China is interested in restoring China's centrality to the world system. And China's first concern is going to be to create an East Asian community, and it's got to come to terms with both Japan and with Korea, which I think will be a reunited Korea in the next 10 years. It's got to figure out how it relates to these countries. It's got to solve the Taiwan problem. And when it does all of that, and Japan will play a big role in that, then China will be a very, very strong force, economically, politically, and militarily. India is somewhat different. India is caught in between. India is not sure who it should line up with. It is not sure that it should line up with China. It's not sure it should line up with the U.S. or with Europe. And I'm not sure what's going to happen with India. India is, of course, an enormous country, and it's had a lot of economic growth in the last few years. I'm not sure that's going to continue all that well, but I leave that as a question mark. You now go to Venezuela. Well, I think Venezuela is an important country, but it's a secondary country next to Brazil. And Brazil is it's quite clear what Brazilian policy is. Brazil wants to create a kind of United Latin American, or at least South American, force. which will move towards economic integration, maybe even towards common currency, and certainly towards a common position on world economic affairs. Brazil also has thoughts of being a military power, not quite as powerful as these others, but, you know, it almost did have an atomic weapon back in the 80s. The irony of it, you know, is that we backed the military to overthrow more democratic governments in Brazil. We put them in power, and then they got these ideas of developing nuclear weapons just when we were on our passion to stop nuclear proliferation. And that's when we shifted line on Brazil. That's when we suddenly became in favor of democracy and down with dictatorships. But anyway, the Brazilians are thinking about doing it again. The Argentine also had a program. They might now have a joint program. All that's a possibility over the next 10 years, and it depends on weaving together a kind of something equivalent to the European Union, but they're at a much more primitive stage. And the U.S. is, of course, fighting it tooth and nail. Brazil is a country you want to keep your eye on in terms of the shifting geopolitics of the world system.
This is Eric Mann. I'm with Tammy Liu. We're on KPFK 90.7 FM. The interview is with Emmanuel Wallerstein, who many of you know from the Fernand Braudel Center in Binghamton University. You're on KPFK 90.7 FM. I think I got that in. I'm going to end up with the elections, but tell us a little bit about, I see in your biography that you've moved to Yale, at least temporarily.
Well, it's a little bit more than temporary. I've retired as a professor at Binghamton. I'm still running the Fernand Braudel Center, but I'll probably retire from that fairly soon. And I'm sitting at Yale as a senior research scholar. So I'm in sort of, I got my foot in both camps for the moment. And now my principal task in life is to write books and to speak on KPFK.
Sounds great. Let's segue to the elections.
Okay.
The book that I wrote, or your article, whichever way you want to go, A Primer on the U.S. Presidential Elections, covers a lot of common ground. I argue for building a broad left united front to defeat Bush as a central democratic question facing the left, facing the black community, facing the peace movement. In my book, I say that you should, well, there's a chapter called Kerry Without Illusions, and it says that Kerry's going to move to the right and even make us disgusted, but it's funny how you can write about it, but then witnessing it is a little harder, even though you anticipate it. Kerry's abandonment of the black community, the Latino community, refusal to use the word abortion, his aggressiveness in Iraq, a stronger America, none of this, his dropping of any civil rights discussion. I just was talking to several activists in the black community who were saying it's very hard to get the vote out for Kerry. It's not hard to get people who traditionally are black and vote Democratic. They're going to vote Democratic. They hate Bush. But this is a man who has really refused to take the kind of risks that we don't know. I mean, you know, who are we on the left to tell somebody on the center, move to the left and you're going to win in a right-wing country? But some of the choices he's making are rather frightening about not destroying, but devaluing his entire base. As you pointed out in the Primer on the U.S. presidential elections, the real issue is no longer economic. Note that Kerry's talking about economic incentives to corporations to stay in the United States. I didn't think a capitalist needed to be paid to exploit the working class. As you pointed out, it's not, unfortunately, going to be on foreign policy, although you have made the distinction, which I made in the book, that Clinton prefers to strangle you through the IMF and the World Bank. He's not primarily trying to invade. And I don't think that's really Kerry's modus operandi if he wins. So I think there will be some disagreements on how imperialism is carried out. As you pointed out, the real differences on these so-called, as you say, there is good reason why 90% of the blacks and 70 to 80% of the Latinos vote Democratic. That is to say, they know that the Republicans are working to undo the rights they have, supporting laws that disenfranchise them, opposing affirmative action, seeking to enact English-only laws and tightening, even closing, immigration flows from the non-white world. One of the things that's very interesting is by Kerry shutting out the debate and not allowing these issues to be raised in the campaign, out of assuming that those of us who understand it will already vote for him, and Nader being marginalized and in my particular proposal, not the candidate of choice right now, but the only one saying many of the things, we're faced in this very, very terrible dilemma where the candidate is running far to the Kerry, that is, far to the right of the people in the United States. And one of the things I've been very critical of the so-called U.S. public, I think the anti-war sentiment in this country this early in the war in Iraq compared to the early days of the anti-Vietnam War work is amazingly good.
Mm-hmm.
And the people are amazingly decent.
Right.
What do you think of that?
Well, I do. But look, we've got 6 weeks to the election. At this point, the only issue is who wins. And nobody's going to change their line very much. And you're undoubtedly right that the way he's projected his line, it doesn't have a lot in it to attract, let's say, skeptical black voters or black non-voters who might become voters or so forth. It doesn't have an appeal, broadly speaking, to the American left. He's trying to get centrist votes. He's building his hopes on that. I'm not sure he's wrong. I'm not sure he's right. But in any case, that's the next 6 weeks, and then we'll know on November 2nd who's the president of the United States. At least I hope we'll know on that day. I hope we don't have another Florida to drag on for 6 weeks. But after that, whether he wins or whether he loses, there's an enormous battle that has to go on inside the Democratic Party. One of the things I said in the primer is, look, we're stuck with a kind of electoral system in the United States which simply makes third parties irrelevant and harmful. And you can moan and groan about that from here to kingdom come, but that's the reality of the structure of American, of the Constitution and so forth. You can't play the game the way you play it in France or Germany or in a lot of other countries. So we're stuck with it, and the people who realized that early on in the last 30 or 40 years was the Christian right, and they realized that they couldn't go out and form another party. All they do is make sure that the Democrats got in that way. So instead, they devoted all their energy to getting in and taking over the Republican Party, which is more or less what they've done, and we've got to think the same way. And we've got to go in and take over the Democratic Party, and then those people who are so right of center or whatever you want to call them, who call themselves Democrats, are going to have to make the same kind of choices that the so-called Republican moderates have to make, which is do I just drop out or do I go along or what? But the left is nowhere near as strong within the Democratic Party, not remotely as strong as the right is within the Republican Party, and that's a game that has to start not today, but the day after the next election, and it's got to go on for many, many years. They worked for 20 years to take over, and bit by bit by bit by bit, they got into the position they're in now, and we can do the same.
Well, as we say, we'll give you the last word, but not quite. The other option is still an oscillation between third parties that do punish the Democratic Party in certain key areas. If, in fact, a significant number of blacks choose even once to take one election and break with the Democratic Party, that may be a tactic that will be necessary to rebuild that left. But the question is not... Well, your main point is that we got a lot of discussions to have. Thank you for your very important work. Parenthetically, you did a book called The University Crisis Reader 4,000 Years Ago.
Mm-hmm.
And I had an article in there called Appraisals and Perspectives about SDS.
Okay.
And thanks so much for that editing, and thanks for your tremendous contribution to intellectual life in this country.
Bye.
Okay. So with that, I want to do one more plug, and we have 2 minutes? 1 minute. You know, one thing's when you become an author is you become a self-promoter. Or maybe you are a self-promoter and then you become an author. But anyway, the this Saturday that's been already announced is that ADA is having an excellent book fair at the, where's it going to be? At the, help me here. The ADA is going to have a book fair at the LA Convention Center from the 9:30 until about 4. I'll be one of 20 authors there talking about my new book, The 2004 Elections, A Turning Point for the U.S. Left. And as John Stewart from the Daily Show said, hey, folks, you remember reading? So to go out and buy all 20 books of all the authors, to spend a day meeting with authors, discussing the future of the elections, that'll be great. We're going to take a short break, and then Tammy Liu's going to come back with an excellent interview with Jeff Cohn from Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. You're on the KPFK 4 o'clock hour. Voices from the Frontlines, Eric Mann saying, we'll take a break, and I'll talk to you soon.